Welcome to today's program titled Enforcing Trade Secret and Non-Compete Provisions in Franchise Agreement. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. For those of you who are interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on all CLE attendance affirmation forms. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. The Seyfarth Shaw legal disclaimer is now on your screen for your reference. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn the program over to John Skelton. You may begin.
Thank you. Again, my name is John Skelton. I am the co-chair of the firm's Franchise and Distribution Practice Group, and I'd like to welcome you to today's webinar. I'm joined by my colleagues, James and Dawn, and I would ask that each of them, maybe starting with Dawn, if you could just introduce yourself.
Sure. Thank you, John. My name is Dawn Mertnight. I'm an associate here in the Boston office of Seyfarth, and I'm a member of both the Franchise Group and the Trade Secret and Non-Compete Group here at Seyfarth.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is James Yu from Seyfarth's New York City office. I'm also a member of the Trade Secrets Practice Group, and I represent both plaintiffs and defendants in prosecuting and defending trade secrets claims.
Thank you, Dawn and James. This is a one of our continuing webinar series on the Trade Secrets blog and also by the firm's Franchise and Distribution Practice Group. And non-compete agreements and protecting trade secret information relating to in the franchise context continues to be a hot topic. And we are going to what we're going to cover are why those non-compete agreements are so important in the franchise context, some basic issues and considerations to keep in mind. Dawn is going to update us on a number of state-specific issues and various legislative initiatives relating to non-competes, all of which is a relatively recent trend, and it's an important one for everyone to keep an eye on. James is going to cover some considerations for onboarding and terminating employees in the franchise arena, and that too is becoming more and more important, especially for the franchisees out there who have their own network of employees to deal with. So without further ado, let's get going. Why are the non-competes so important? First of all, we have our, you know, with our own employees, the franchisors and the franchisees, it's clearly a hot topic. For franchisors, the non-competes now and enforcing them and requiring franchisees to have them can trigger a joint employer risk. Obviously, a cornerstone of franchise agreements and franchise system are confidential information and trade secrets. They need to be protected. And for many franchisors, the value in the system is the system itself, and they want to protect the integrity of that system and want to prevent a former franchisee from competing against the system and the former franchisee. So protecting the integrity of the system is an important role with non-compete agreements. And because it is so prevalent in the franchise system, virtually every time a franchise agreement is terminated or not renewed, there are enforcement considerations that both the franchisor and the franchisee have to take into account because, as I said, virtually every franchise agreement is going to have some sort of restrictive covenant. A couple of the considerations, and obviously, we're assuming that everybody on the webinar has some basic understanding of non-compete and their role in the context. Again, they're almost universal, both interim non-competes, post-term non-competes, pretty relevant in the franchise system because in every franchise disclosure document, item 17 requires the franchisor to identify the scope and terms of a non-compete if it's included in the franchise agreement. So it's front and center in the relationships. All the employees or many employees are now being asked to sign non-competes, and that's raising a significant issue depending upon their status. Every time a franchise gets sold, most of the buy-sell agreements have some sort of separate non-compete agreement that plays into it needs to be taken into account. The cornerstone from both the franchisor and franchisee perspective is protecting the legitimate business interest. That is the key consideration, and it varies widely from state to state. The preliminary injunctions and TROs are the battleground. The continuing cases that we're going to talk about, or some recent cases that we're going to talk about a little bit later, continue to prove that winning the TRO, winning the preliminary injunction is where the battle is fought. Everybody knows the general preliminary injunction standards, and the fight is usually all about irreparable harm. As I indicated, state law is becoming more and more important, and it is really the starting point. And everyone needs to understand and consider the applicable state law in the jurisdiction that they're dealing with, and many states are now focusing on specific non-compete legislation. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dawn for her to talk about some of those state-specific issues.
Thank you, John. As he mentioned, I will talk about state-specific issues, although I wanted to start briefly on some federal issues. Most recently, the White House released a report just last month entitled Non-Compete Agreements, Analysis of the Usage, Potential Issues, and State Responses, which focuses on the alleged misuse and negative impacts of these agreements, such as, for example, effects on wages, innovation, entrepreneurship, and economic growth. Now, the report did acknowledge that non-compete agreements can play an important role in protecting businesses and that they have value in certain cases, but ultimately the White House report concluded that the potential harm of misuse by employers outweighs those benefits. Specifically, the report noted that there is a growing movement in states to take action to limit the misuse of non-compete agreements, which again we'll address in just a few minutes. Now, the report identified 7 alleged problem areas, and you can see them on this slide. I'm not going to read all of them, but I wanted to point out the first one, which is bolded, which is relevant for our presentation today. The report claims that low-wage workers are unlikely to possess trade secrets, and yet they are still required to sign a non-compete. So on that point, the report alleges that about 15% of workers without 4-year college degrees are bound by non-compete agreements, and it further claims that about 14% of workers making less than $40,000 annually are also bound by these agreements. Now, the report alleges that workers in both of these categories are about half as likely or even less than half as likely to possess trade secrets than other workers. Now, it's important to note a couple of things here. First, trade secrets are not the only protectable interest that an employer might have. We've talked about this before on some of our webinars, and you'll hear more about it later, but there are other protectable interests. The other thing to keep in mind is that these numbers are self-reported. So it may be that workers are saying that they don't have access to trade secrets, but maybe they actually do and they just don't understand what a trade secret is, or they're not clear on what it is that their employer considers a trade secret. It may be that the person who's responding to this report or to the questioning contained in the report knows that they're in possession of trade secrets, but for whatever reason didn't report that. The other thing to note is that the report points out that there's been a lot of media coverage about enforcement of non-competes against low-wage workers, including in the fast food industry, which, again, we'll talk about that in just a second. There are also a couple of federal legislative efforts that I wanted to bring to your attention before I move to the state issues. The first is the Fair Franchise Act of 2015. It's not likely to pass. There hasn't been any action on this bill since September of last year when it was referred to the House Subcommittee on the Constitution and Civil Justice. But if it did pass, it would prohibit franchisors from requiring franchisees to have its employees sign non-competes. The other relevant federal legislation to bring up here is the Mobility and Opportunity for Vulnerable Employees Act, or the MOVE Act. That would prohibit non-competes for low-wage workers. And that's defined as employees earning the greater of $15 per hour or the applicable state or local minimum wage rate, or $31,200 per year. It would exclude salaried employees who earn more than $5,000 per month for two consecutive months. But again, currently, there's no indication that either of these will pass. Moving on to the state legislative actions, there are two bills, or two statutes that passed that I wanted to bring to your attention. The first is the Oregon one. It provides that, among other things, non-competes are voidable unless the employee's annual gross salary and commission at the time of the termination exceeds the median family income for a four-person family. Now, that's pretty significant because the last data I could find on this, whether you're looking at Oregon or nationally, the median family income for a family of four is somewhere in the range of $60,000 to $75,000. And then the Idaho statute here limits non-competes to key employees. So again, that's significant. The way this could affect your business is that certain employees in the franchise chain wouldn't necessarily be considered a key employee. There are several states that have addressed potential solutions as far as the legislators consider it, that have not yet passed, and I'll talk about those right now. Most recently, in Massachusetts, there was a bill proposed last month that would prohibit non-competes for employees classified as non-exempt under the Fair Labor Standards Act. This is potentially concerning because the FLSA's overtime exemptions can be a moving target. And we actually saw that fairly recently where the FLSA's overtime exemptions changed. So it's unclear whether, if an employee, for example, is considered exempt under the FLSA at the time he or she signs the agreement, but then let's say 6 months or a year later, the FLSA changes and that person then becomes not exempt, it's unclear whether the non-compete agreement would be enforceable or not. So we'll see if that changes at all, if the legislators are going to pick up on that issue, but we'll see if the bill passes at all. There is also a bill introduced in Maryland in February of this year that would ban non-competes for employees earning $15 per hour or $31,200 annually. Again, that is similar to what we saw with the MOVE Act that I just spoke about a few minutes ago. And in New York, there was a bill introduced last year that would clarify the law of New York in the wake of the BDO-Seidman versus Hirschberg case, and it would confirm that lower-level employees cannot be bound by restrictive covenants. A couple more states that are looking at this issue. Michigan, in February of this year, introduced a bill that would prohibit non-competes for low-wage workers. And in Washington state, there are two bills that I want to bring to your attention. One was introduced last year, but reintroduced this year. and it would ban non-competes for workers entitled to overtime or earning $39,000 or less annually. And then there was a separate bill introduced this year that would create a presumption that non-competes for employees who aren't executive employees are unreasonable. Now, obviously, it's a rebuttable presumption, but obviously that's something that's pretty key to limit non-competes to executive employees. Now, state-specific statutes aren't the only thing to worry about. You should beware of attorney general or other enforcement authority actions, even when there are no specific laws on the books. Most recently, you might have seen the news coming out of Illinois, where Jimmy John's was sued by the attorney general on its use of non-competes. So we'll see what happens with that, but that's obviously something that franchisors ought to be thinking about and concerned about, even if the states where they operate don't have specific statutes that would limit the use of non-competes. But again, you need to remember, as John mentioned earlier, a non-compete must be necessary to protect the franchisor's legitimate business interests. As I mentioned earlier, trade secrets is one of those legitimate business interests, but there's also confidential information, franchisor goodwill. The definition of what constitutes a legitimate business interest varies from state to state, but it's fairly clear that you can't simply seek to prevent ordinary competition. Some other state-specific quirks I want to bring to your attention are what a court will do if it determines that a non-compete is unenforceable. So there are three general policies here. There's blue pencil, red pencil, and reformation. So blue pencil means that a court, if it finds that a non-compete provision is overly broad, it will literally strike out only the overly restrictive language and enforce the remainder of the clause if it determines that the remainder is reasonable. So for example, a non-compete provision might state that the signer of the agreement cannot open a competing coffee shop, let's say, in Massachusetts or New York. A court might say, well, you know, this coffee shop that the person is operating now is located in Boston. I think New York is too far away, so I'm literally just going to cross out New York. And that will leave a restriction of Massachusetts, which I find is reasonable. Red pencil, on the other hand, essentially means that if the court finds any part of the provision overly broad, the court will strike down the provision in its entirety. So even if Massachusetts would be a reasonable scope, the court will not enforce the non-compete provision. Finally, reformation allows the court to rewrite the overly restrictive language, and that could include adding language. So for example, in the same example we've been using, the court might find that New York is too broad and might even find that Massachusetts as a whole is too broad, but the court might say Suffolk County, Middlesex County, that's sufficient, so I'm going to add those terms to the non-compete agreement. The majority of states are reformation states. I think it's about 30 at this point. Then there are a handful of blue pencil states and really only a few red pencil states. I think it's three at this point, although the Massachusetts bill that I was just discussing a minute ago, if it passes, would make Massachusetts a red pencil state as well. And finally, some states are undecided. And finally, before I turn this over to James, just a reminder, most of you probably know that California generally prohibits non-compete agreements, but North Dakota and Oklahoma also do as well, with some exceptions. And there are states that are considering banning non-competes entirely. Pennsylvania, there is a state representative there who has claimed that he will introduce a bill this year to ban non-competes entirely. It hasn't happened, but it may yet. Rhode Island introduced such a bill in 2015, which is currently stalled, and Washington State introduced a bill in 2015. It was reintroduced in 2016, but that one is also currently stalled. The one thing I want to mention is that you might want to consider a choice of law provision in these agreements, but don't rely too heavily on them. The Doctors Associates case that you see cited here is an interesting case. It actually involved a New York franchise. All of the employees, customers, and equipment at issue were located in New York, and again, the store itself was in New York. and the defendants claimed that they had reviewed and signed the agreement in New York and that the parties' interactions with each other were almost exclusively made through an agent in New York, yet there was a Connecticut choice of law provision. The court actually upheld the Connecticut choice of law provision based on the fact that the franchisee had communicated with the plaintiff's corporate offices and legal department in Connecticut. And the court acknowledged that there were significant contacts with New York, but still upheld the Connecticut choice of law provision. But again, this is one case. You shouldn't rely too heavily on this, but it is something to consider. And with that, I will turn this over to James.
Thanks, Dawn. Before I continue, get out your pens, because I'm going to read out the CLE code. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you at the end of this week. The code is SS8096. Again, that is SS as in Seyfarth Shaw, 8096. Okay. We've been focusing a lot of attention about the protection of the franchisor's trade secrets through confidentiality and non-compete provisions in franchise agreements. But what do you do about employees of the franchisee who also have access to those trade secrets as part of their employment? Well, as Dawn mentioned, in most jurisdictions, non-competes and confidentiality agreements and employment agreements are generally enforceable to the extent that they're reasonably necessary to protect the legitimate business interests of the franchisee and the franchisor as well. And here we're talking about trade secrets, goodwill, things of that nature. And generally, as you can see, they have been disfavored, at least legislatively, against lower-level employees. So when we're talking about enforcement of these types of agreements, we're really talking about higher-level employees who generally and undisputedly do have access to these trade secrets. Restrictive covenants and franchise agreements must, of course, be reasonably limited in time and geographic scope. That same standard applies to employee restrictive covenants as well, but they're likely going to be more strictly scrutinized based upon the employee's position within the franchisee, the types of access, the type of information they have access to, the level of access that the employee had to the trade secrets at issue, how the restrictions might impact that specific employee's ability to make a living. You know, the traditional standards that a court would look at when debating enforcement of a restrictive covenant. Of course, first you have to demonstrate the existence of a trade secret, meaning one, the information must not be generally known to the public, and two, that reasonable means have been taken to keep the information secret. The non-compete must also be limited in time and scope, as I mentioned earlier. So keep in mind that the non-compete and confidentiality obligations and franchise agreements may also be enforceable against non-signatories who have access to trade secrets. Franchisees are typically family-owned and operated, and franchisees will often try, in the types of cases that have come up in these contexts, to circumvent non-compete and confidentiality obligations through their family members. As a general rule, restrictive covenants and franchise agreements should be drafted to apply to all officers and directors of the franchisee, but when in doubt, Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 65D2, which governs injunctions and restraining orders, binds officers, agents, servants, employees, and attorneys, and all, quote, other persons in active participation or in concert with them. So if you find yourself in a position to move, where you have to move for injunctive relief or a TRO, that you present in your draft order to the court language to make sure that it's covering everyone that is associated with the operation of the franchisee and their accomplices, not just officers and directors. So on this next slide, I provided some examples of the types of information courts have found to constitute trade secrets or legally protectable in the franchisor-franchisee context. You can look at them later because I think we're running short on time, so I just want to move along. Earlier, I talked about how one of the elements of proving the existence of a trade secret requires a showing of reasonable efforts to maintain the secrecy of the information. This is particularly important when onboarding new employees. So while the law doesn't mandate a Fort Knox level of protection, one key component that is almost always considered, whether employees with access to the trade secrets are required as a condition of employment to execute confidentiality agreements or non-disclosure agreements. Other ways courts will look at when assessing whether reasonable efforts were taken to protect trade secrets include whether access is limited or not to the employees on a need-to-know basis. There are obviously, when we're talking about franchisees, the people on the lowest rung of the employment ladder generally shouldn't have access to the franchisee's trade secrets. Proper security measures such as password protection and email policies should be used with respect to electronic data and computer systems. Employees should receive regular training regarding the company's confidentiality policies. Swift action should be taken against any breaches, and a proper protocol should always be put in place to conduct formal exit interviews of any departing employees, whether they resign voluntarily or are terminated. Because there is no direct contractual privity between the franchisor and the franchisee's employees, franchisors should require their franchisees to execute confidentiality agreements and non-competes with their employees before giving them access to the franchisor's trade secrets. Proper onboarding and termination procedures should be in place with respect to each employee who will be providing access to trade secrets, because the most common misappropriator of trade secret employees is the rogue or disloyal employee. If you've been on any of our prior webinars, you'll know that we spent a lot of time talking about, I think its statistics show as high as 90% of trade secrets of a company generally leave through a disgruntled employee. There's, of course, a myriad of tools, particularly when information is stored electronically, that employees could use to potentially steal massive amounts of data. Common ones include the use of external storage devices. Camera phones is a really problematic one that has come up recently. Email attachments and social media accounts. So how does one protect himself against the rogue or negligent employee? Effective protection of trade secrets against disloyal or negligent employees really starts at the onboarding process, so I can't stress that enough. The franchisee should have proper protocols in place when hiring new employees. First, stress the importance of confidentiality when onboarding new employees. Don't just hand them lengthy forms to fill out or to sign that they may or may not read. Actually discuss with them the importance of the franchisor's trade secrets through an introductory interview process. You also, of course, need to make sure when hiring employees that they don't take their former employer's secrets with them. If they do, that's a red flag that the employee may not be trustworthy or may not understand the critical importance of keeping the franchisee's information confidential. And, of course, the franchisee might have to worry about a lawsuit when onboarding a new employee from the competitor, from a potential competitor. So when interviewing a prospective employee who was previously employed at a high level, particularly at a high level by a competing franchise, discuss the candidate's general skills and talent and not talk about the former employer's processes or operations or their trade secrets. Finally, when hiring, make sure that the employee returns its former employer's property. Obviously, if they bring stuff with them from a prior employer, you not only open yourself up to liability, but it calls into doubt the trustworthiness of that employee. So, you know, you can count on the fact that if they leave the franchisee, that they may end up doing the same thing to you as well. Regularly communicate the importance of confidentiality through employment will also help ensure the protection of trade secret information from inappropriate disclosure. It goes without saying, but internal or confidential documents should be marked accordingly. If documents are in electronic format, they should be accessible in password-protected databases. This is pretty much a universally required element for a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim that information be accessible on a protected device. If documents are in hard copy, they should be kept under lock and key when not in use to protect any employees who shouldn't have access to that information from accessing that information. Finally, consider investing in systems that will monitor employee information. This includes implementing software tools that tracks access and download activities on an employee basis. Emails should be routinely monitored, particularly if employees have the ability to mail information to their personal email accounts. There's a number of software tools out there that can be tailored to pick up suspicious email activity using certain search terms. And although operationally it may be a big cost, particularly to franchisees who with specific profit margins, it's a worthwhile investment in the long run to the extent that there's a particular concern, especially when employees, we're dealing with franchises with high employee turnover, that you take reasonable measures to protect the information to maintain the secrecy of that information. When an employee resigns or is terminated, you should always conduct an exit interview. Before conducting the interview, check the employee's computer activities so that you can have an informed discussion with them about what they were doing on their computers prior to their exit. Create a checklist of procedures that should be followed when the employee leaves. This checklist should include a requirement that all company hardware and devices have been returned, that any company information from personal devices is removed. If you know the employee is going to a competitor, you should obviously inform the employee of his or her obligations in both to both the franchisee and the franchisor as being the ultimate owner of the trade secret information at issue. Have the employee sign a certification acknowledging their understanding and commitment to these obligations so that you can potentially use that in a lawsuit if you need to go there. While it may be, again, impractical for a smaller outfit, again, as a matter of best practices, any and all data or any email or device that was used or accessed by the employee should be preserved to the extent possible. And then finally, I just want to talk about in the event the franchisor terminates its relationship with the franchisee or vice versa. The franchisee should keep in mind that the non-competes and confidentiality obligations signed by its employees survive termination. Keep in mind that the franchisor, again, is the penultimate owner of the trade secret information, and the employment agreements should be drafted to reflect that. I'm now going to turn this over to John to provide an update on recent enforcement decisions that have come out in the past year.
Thank you, James. We did have a request to repeat the CLE code. I think a couple people may have missed it. Again, it's SS as in Seyfarth Shaw 8096, SS 8096. So what I want to talk about is four relatively recent decisions that I think are worth noting in the enforcement issue of non-competes. Each focuses on a pretty important issue that both franchisors and departing franchisees need to be thinking about when there is a termination or non-renewal. The first is a MACO case that was in North Carolina. There was a franchisee was post-termination continued to operate a body shop. The franchisee removed all the signs, changed its name, said that it put away all of the confidential information and thus was not using any of the system, the franchise system information. It did keep the phone number, but it wasn't a unique phone number. It wasn't like 1-800-MAKO or anything like that. On its part, the franchisor made absolutely no effort to get back the signs or any of its confidential information or operating manuals, and in fact had no communication whatsoever with the former franchisees for 2 years until it filed for a preliminary injunction to enforce the non-compete. That effort was denied because the court held the franchisor did not carry its burden to prove that there was irreparable harm. There was no evidence presented of any loss of sales or customers. The court focused on the fact that MACO had not undertaken to reestablish a franchisee in that former market area and used the word inexcusable to describe Mako's failure to do any follow-up with respect to this former franchisee for 2 years. The next is a decision out of Canada. A home healthcare equipment franchise had a post-termination non-compete that said you can't operate a competing business for 18 months and within 30 miles. The franchise agreement expired. The franchisee wanted to continue to operate, so again, removed all the signage And so one of the things you see here in this case, as well as the Mako case, the former franchisee was not trying to capitalize on the franchisor's trademarks, signs, and the like. It was, however, operating an identical business, albeit with a new name, out of the very same location. There was a contractual non-compete in the franchise agreement the franchisor sought to enforce. The trial court ruled in favor of the franchisor and enforced that non-compete because the trial court looked at the legitimate business interest as one of, quote, protecting the franchise system itself. Not necessarily factually specific about this particular market area or this particular franchisee, but just being able to protect the integrity of the system itself. That was on appeal, that was overturned. And while the appeals court said that the non-compete provision, 18 months, 30 miles, was generally okay and reasonable, under the circumstances here, so it was fact specific, but under the circumstances here, there was no legitimate business interest on the part of the franchisor to be protected. The significant thing in this case was that the franchisor had no intention of reestablishing a franchisee in that market. All it really wanted to do was prevent its former franchisee from operating a business. It wasn't like, because it wasn't going to be reestablishing in that market, no one was going to be competing with the franchise system and it wouldn't be losing any kind of sales. So ultimately, the court said, "Well, why should I bar the former franchisee from operating, conducting a business if the franchisor has no interest in competing in that particular marketplace?" The third case is another home healthcare system case. Again, the former franchisee was terminated for non-payment of fees. There was a little bit of a dispute back and forth. Like the others, it continued to operate. Here, it operated using a different name and a different location. The non-compete provision in the franchise agreement was important because by executing that non-compete, the franchisee was acknowledging that the franchisor would suffer irreparable harm if the franchisee violated the agreement. That is a very common provision in a number of agreements where you get the franchisee to acknowledge the scope of your legitimate business interest and, more importantly, that if there's a violation, the franchisor would be suffering irreparable harm. The district court, in dealing with that, refused to issue a preliminary injunction, ruling that there was no irreparable harm proven. First, and as it's commonplace, the court noted that the standard for a preliminary injunction is an extraordinary remedy, and so therefore it was going to require the franchisor to prove each and every element of the case. And here the court found that there was no irreparable harm. Some of the factors that the court focused on in finding no irreparable harm is, once again, this was a situation where the former franchisee was not using the franchisor's trademarks. Oftentimes you have the former franchisee who rebrands very closely associated with the franchisor's name. It's trying to maybe use the same location, the same color scheme, the same image associated with it, really trying to get some consumer confusion and be able to trade off the goodwill and the name of the franchisor. In these series of cases, that wasn't present. While it was also, the court also said, the franchisee was not at the same location. And oftentimes, franchisors can point to what I will call a locational goodwill, that if you establish goodwill associated with your customers going to a particular spot for a particular restaurant or a particular service or the like, there may be, I think that you can develop an argument that you have goodwill associated with that particular location. This franchisee also gave back the phone number. Oftentimes that's a big fight because they don't want to give back the phone number, but they did. And the franchisee told its clients that it was no longer affiliated with the franchisor. So that here, this franchisee seems to be very well counseled because it took a lot of steps to disassociate itself from the franchisor, avoid consumer confusion, notwithstanding the fact that there was a non-compete. And the court noted that there was no evidence of any consumer confusion or customer confusion. In the end, simply enforcing a contractual agreement to not to compete was not enough. You had to be able to show irreparable harm. You had to be able to go through the preliminary injunction standards, and here that wasn't enough. The final case is a very recent case in March of this year, an Amoco case out of Pennsylvania, because that's where the franchisor was located, but it involved a former Amoco dealer in Florida. That former franchisee sold its business and obviously as part of the sale terminated its franchise agreement. It then moved 90 miles away. I believe it was they were located in Hollywood, Florida, and they moved to another Stuart, Florida, and opened up a new transmission repair shop under a different name. Now, even though they were 90 miles away from their former location, they were within a couple miles of another Amoco franchisee. Amoco sought a preliminary injunction and did not get it. The franchisee sought a declaratory judgment case, and it went towards trial. The judge denied the preliminary injunction as unenforceable as it was written and as it was applied. Again, here Amoco was focused on its legitimate business interest being protecting the franchise system itself, but that was not enough for the court. It noted that there was no evidence that customers were following the former franchisee 90 miles up the road to another location. It was not competing with the buyer who bought the original shop in Hollywood, Florida. So there, the court was focused on competition with the former location in Hollywood, Florida, and not with other franchisees in the system. Once again, they weren't using confidential information, they weren't using the trademarks, and this particular franchisee was an experienced transmission shop operator prior to joining the Amoco system. So Amoco couldn't point to the former franchisee as learning all of the skills associated with operating the business from Amoco itself and the Amoco system. The court also noted, and this is just a reality of that balance of harms issue that we all face when we're dealing with preliminary injunctions or permanent injunctions, the balance of harms. By the time of trial, the former franchisee had been operating for 2 years. So the judge would have had to have shut down a operating business, and that was going to be a significant issue. So it was overly broad and denied. A couple of the takeaways, I think, from these four cases are you have to prove impact on competition, especially in those cases where you don't have a trademark violation and they're not using your goodwill and the like. You really have to show that you're going back in the market, you want to go back into the market, they're stealing your customers. Show a loss of sales. You might have to have some market studies. You might have to have some consumer surveys, but you're going to have to present some evidence, and you simply can't rely upon the agreement. Clearly, don't wait. Both Amoco and Mako waited 2 years. That was a big issue. Courts unlikely to want to shut down an existing business. Don't wait. That means that you should really develop, the franchisor should have a post-termination plan simply beyond issuing a notice of termination. Assess, strategize, enforce, get back your signs, get back the confidential information, do something more than simply a cease and a desist letter, because if you don't act, you may well be barred. On the franchisee side, obviously, I think these four cases stand for the proposition that if done right, franchisees may be able to avoid the enforcement of those non-compete agreements. Develop irreparable harm. Develop evidence of irreparable harm, confusion, diversion. Are they trading off your training? Do you need to clear the market in order to be able to sell back into, to be able to replace the former franchisee? And in terms of liquidated damages, keep in mind that if you have a liquidated damages provision, that may actually hurt you, because if you have a monetary remedy, that may affect your ability to prove irreparable harm. We got a question earlier about, you know, how would a franchisor enforce a non-compete against an employee where you may not be able to have non-compete agreements. Well, one of the other things that you should be considering is other avenues to protect trade secrets, confidential information, system-related information beyond simply a non-compete agreement, and that's where the non-disclosure agreements, the confidentiality agreements, Trade Secrets Acts of 2016 allows for claims against people who are stealing your trade secret information. So consider other avenues. Obviously, take a look at your agreements, and in particular, a couple things are. Joint employer risk is a real big issue for franchisors now. Dawn touched upon it with the Jimmy John's case and other enforcement actions by state AGs and the like. They're going after franchisors in New York. There's a claim against Domino's against the franchisor for actions of the franchisee. If you exercise too much control, you may be deemed a joint employer, and that becomes a problem. And how is it, when you're reviewing your agreement, how do you define your legitimate business interest? And again, while the acknowledgement of irreparable harm may not be enough, getting the franchisee to acknowledge the legitimacy of that business interest becomes important. And probably most fundamental is, how does your agreement define the terms in terms of time, geography, and scope? Are they reasonable? Because the last thing you want is an overly broad non-compete agreement that you have to rely upon either reformation or blue penciling to get it to be enforceable. I think that we're just about up with our time. I did respond to one of the questions that we got. If there are other questions here that unfortunately we're just not going to be able to get a chance to respond to, we will. If you've asked a question that we didn't answer, we will respond to it via email. If you think of some now and you want to send them in, please do so. One of the things is that you can stay connected with us. We have a trade secret blog that I would strongly suggest that you sign up for and read. There's some great information on there. As a firm, we try and provide a series of webinars on a regular basis, trying to address the most relevant and recent issues. And if there's any questions that you have that we didn't get to, please send them in. You can contact James, Dawn, or myself. And we very much appreciate you tuning in and listening to our non-compete webinar.
And I just want to follow up on that one question very quickly about whether a non-compete that might be unenforceable in a particular state, in this case it was Oregon, what can a franchisor do? A couple things I wanted to point out really quickly before our time ends. With respect to the Oregon statute, it's limited to non-compete agreements between employers and employees. So if the concern is a non-compete provision between a franchisor and franchisee where the franchisee is not considered an employee, you might not have that issue. The statute does not affect customer or employee non-solicit agreements, so that's another avenue you could go. Finally, you can save the non-compete provision in your Oregon agreement if you pay garden leave, essentially. So if you pay compensation equal to the greater of 50% of the employee's annual gross base or 50% of the median family income for a family of four, then you can still uphold the non-compete agreement. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, and just to add to that, Dawn, if there is a concern, obviously, that trade secrets have been stolen, as was posed in the question, you still have common law misappropriation claims that can be asserted for wrongful theft of trade secrets.
Thank you very much to all of our speakers. I just want to give any of you an opportunity to make any final remarks you have at this time before we conclude our webinar. Okay. Well, this concludes today's webinar. I want to thank you all for attending, and you may now disconnect.